one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
Eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one, zero.
Cut, Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday, the 16th of September in the glorious future year of 2023, and I am coming to you today by pre-recording, although without any considerable degree of polish or editing, because I'm doing it in a hurry, in order that I can get to the anime club meeting. Although I'm not looking forward to the hour's drive each way, considering that I haven't been sleeping well the last few days owing to sinus pain. Well, first order of business is to read you a lovely letter which I received. Quote, I'm writing this letter to say hello to you and see how things are going out there in Texas. My husband is originally from Texas, around the Houston area. He keeps telling me we will visit it sometime. It's more of a show you where I grew up kind of thing. I've really enjoyed being on SDF for these last several years. It's a great little space away from the larger, more chaotic internet. Seeing as I've been running around all corners of this WWW since 1995, I am glad a place still exists that exemplifies what I remember it to be. How long it will remain such, I cannot say. I am totally going to admit to not having listened to your show but once or twice, mostly because talk-related radio has never been my favorite thing. I've always preferred music content. I know that right now I am writing on pleb paper, but I've not money for nicer paper, considering I rarely use it for anything other than print-offs and the many, many poems I write. I buy a ton of these cheap notepads for just that purpose. I am no Rimbaud, but it's the one thing I am pretty good at after all these years. I am going to include one of the poems I wrote a while back on the following page, along with some things I found, mint, in storage recently. Hoping you are doing well in your pursuits, take care. The things referred to are a couple of $2 bills, which I accept with great grace, as I will always accept money sent to me. And the poem follows, titled City Lights. Standing on the bridge across the river, I am so far from knowledge, yet in the boat I row slow, fantasizing on the city in the distance, its scenery firmly in another world. The ring of opposing opinions aside, I hope to visit some day, if only in pursuit of wonder. Sincerely, etc. But yes, that from a correspondent in Las Casas, Tennessee, and I have written up a reply, which includes a couple of poems that you will have heard on this program, if you've been listening a lot, and will mail that on my way to the anime club meeting, when I visit my post office box to pick up whatever mail has accumulated since Tuesday. I should give you a progress report on the cyanotypes. We had some sunshine yesterday afternoon, which enabled me to make a trial exposure of one of the three batches of paper I had treated. I will say that the results are not discouraging, and that's about as far as I'm willing to go, unfortunately, at this point. The trouble seems to be that I had been treating the thinner paper by sponging the cyanotype solution onto it, and I seem to have great difficulty getting an even coverage. That is to say that I get areas where there are blobs of stuff on the surface, and areas which lack any coverage. And I think this may be due to some difference in the surface texture of the paper, because it seems to occur in geometrical shapes. But I'm going to see if I can do anything with drafting vellum, because I believe I have some put away somewhere. Now, as for material things to talk about today, you will undoubtedly have heard by now of the earthquake in the Atlas Mountains of Morocco, which has killed well over 2,000 people and left many more homeless and destitute. It's a terrible thing. And there's not much to be done about it except by increasing the overall wealth of the poorer regions of the world, which will enable them to build sturdier structures and to have better roads and rails, means of communication with the outside world, so that help can get to a place when it's needed, and in general have greater reserves so that when something goes wrong, it's possible to address it. And, of course, increasing the overall wealth of society pretty much demands increasing the consumption of energy there. Now, Morocco is known, particularly the southern part of Morocco, as some of the most favorable territory for solar energy in the whole world. The south-facing slopes of the high mountains have been identified as the most promising sites, particularly for solar thermal plants, within reach of Europe. And of course, there are people who want to build large numbers of such plants in the mountains and then run a power cable from Africa to Europe. I have, in the past, described this as an ill-thought-out scheme on the ground that Europe isn't any better off depending on North Africa for its energy in the form of electricity delivered from sunshine than in the form of oil. There is great political difficulty with the suggestion, not to mention, and this seems obvious enough, the continuing question of what do the people in the country get out of it? Is it going to make them wealthier? Because we keep seeing that in oil-exporting countries, the revenue very often does not go to improving the overall condition of life of the people. In which case, what good is it all? No, friends, I do think that what Europe needs most is to concentrate on breeder reactors which will use the uranium and plutonium which have already passed through power reactors in Europe, thus substantially indigenizing the fuel supply. But it's been a bad week for North Africa all around, because no sooner had relief efforts begun in Morocco than you had a powerful storm dumping a whole bunch of rain on Libya, a desert country, resulting in the collapse of the Wadi Derna dams. They're just gone. And they took a big chunk of the middle of a major city with them, and it's estimated to have killed 20,000 people. What can we say about this? These dams were apparently built in the 1970s for flood control purposes. And the trouble with flood control dams is, if they become overwhelmed, then the result is worse than having had no dam in the first place. But apparently they hadn't been maintained for years and years, and there was some international funds meant to be spent for maintenance, which, according to the Wall Street Journal at least, had simply been pocketed by somebody. It doesn't help that Libya currently is not under a united government, although anyone who's read of the history of King Idris of Libya will realize that this is not a new situation. The east and west of the country have historically not all fallen under a single government, pretty much until the period of Italian domination. But, at least according to the notice which appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the municipal authorities had sent out a warning telling people in the middle of town where the river runs to get out. And then the Russian-backed government, which controls the wider area, had sent out a countermanding message telling people to remain in their homes. Why in the world they did this, I cannot even conceive. Don't interfere with local authorities in a matter of this kind, because they have some idea what's going on. Again, of course, I will remark that this sudden destruction of 20,000 human lives in a big chunk of a city is considerably more catastrophic than the worst nuclear accident. You know, as I continue to say, you know, Chernobyl is beyond the worst possible accident. I know that sounds like a paradox, but it really is. Nobody thought that you could have a nuclear reactor accident which would suddenly disperse at least a third of the core material, just throw it out over the landscape or belch it into the air. And yet the consequences of that accident have not been anything like as large as was initially thought. Nuclear power plants just aren't all that dangerous in comparison to dams, and dams are a great deal more common. Now, of course, if we were to get the energy this world needs and get it from fission, nuclear power plants would become a great deal more common. And so we're entitled to ask, would they also become a great deal less safe? This is an interesting question. You know, at the present time, in any politically unstable country, or in any economically unstable country, if it happens to have nuclear power, you will find that there are international assistance missions of every character which will try to make sure that the nuclear facilities are safe, whether in operation or just to shut them down safely. Clearly, when it comes to dams, things are a lot more relaxed, because people are more accustomed to dams, even though, again, there have been repeated dam failures which have killed thousands of people. But so much more apprehension attaches to nuclear energy that it's easy to get people into a country. The authorities there will accept it to help operate or help protect nuclear facilities. This is clearly not the case with dams. And so we may ask, does the reduction in fear and the improvement in public acceptance, which seems absolutely necessary if we are to have a large increase of nuclear power, does that hold out the danger that it will become less safe? And to some extent, perhaps it does. On the other hand, I think it can reasonably be argued that nuclear facilities are inherently safe in a certain sense. That is to say, a dam, for example, holds back an enormous quantity of water, and owing, for example, to sudden rain showers, that quantity of water can be suddenly increased in a way that's quite beyond any human control. On the other hand, nuclear energy facilities don't rely on sheer magnitude or quantity for their function. Nuclear energy facilities rely on precision engineering. And if that engineering is properly done at the time of manufacture, the most likely outcome for failing to keep it up, right, failing to maintain it properly, is just that things break down and stop working. There is not this huge reservoir of potential energy which can be suddenly augmented by forces beyond human control. So in that sense, I do believe it's fair to say that nuclear power plants are safer than dams. Now, I keep harping on this idea of international assistance missions. Of course, there's the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, and there's this body and that body, and of course, over them all, the International Atomic Energy Agency. Or at least there usually is the International Atomic Energy Agency. Apparently, the countries which contribute to its budget have been failing to do so recently, with the result that they're worrying about being able to keep the lights on in Vienna. Now, this is bad, obviously. The IAEA has a number of very, very useful functions. And it also has some very serious responsibilities, since it was made the body responsible for administration of safeguards against nuclear weapons proliferation. So the question is, why is the IAEA having a budget shortfall when everybody agrees that the things it does are really, really important? I wonder whether the Ukraine war has something to do with this, but surely the Russians wouldn't discontinue their contributions when we consider that they're still exporting nuclear power plants. They've got their people in countries like Bangladesh installing reactors of their manufacture. And it's absolutely necessary for international inspectors to be able to validate that these plants are what they're supposed to be, or they're going to be in big trouble. Nobody is going to say, well, we'll just start this nuclear plant up without having external validation that it's as it's supposed to be. And countries like Bangladesh rely on the IAEA for this kind of thing because they don't have the internal expertise. So I don't know what's going on with this. Let's see. Other notes. I saw, again in the Wall Street Journal, a claim that the installation of fiber optic connections to homes on Indian reservations was incredibly expensive. That in some cases it was costing $55,000, which is more than the assessed value of the house. Now this I cannot understand, because fiber optic cable, by itself, is pretty darn cheap. Now, the glass used in fiber optics is expensive by glass standards, but again, this is mostly a question of precision fabrication, not of costly raw materials. It seems to me that if the houses in question are part of a rural electrification scheme, if they have electric lines running to them, if they have telephone lines running to them, then fairly obviously you can use the existing poles. And fiber optic cable doesn't, I think, cost even as much as a dollar a meter when you buy it in the kind of bulk that large-scale installation projects involve. And of course, there's terminal equipment and repeaters and so on, but I find it very difficult to reach the figure of $55,000 to install fiber optics in a house. It ought to be an order of magnitude less than that at the outside. And so my conclusion is that there is large-scale thievery going on. But the article tried to make the case that, see, this is why you need wireless or satellite broadband or what have you. And I'm going to continue to insist that where wired lines are practical, they're a good solution, they're an appropriate solution, they're probably the most appropriate solution. And I'm sure someone is going to take me to task and say, you just hate anything new. You insist on doing everything the old way. You want circuit switch telephone systems with central battery so that when the power goes out of the house, you can still use the phone. Yes, I do, because I've been having power outages. Doesn't seem so unreasonable, does it? You want central station, steam electric generation, and dumb distribution networks, not modern smart grids with distributed generation. Yeah, because they work. They're very economical, and in terms of maintenance, in terms of breakdowns, you're going to find they really do a lot better. You want electric street railways in cities! Yeah, because they have a proven track record of being a really good way of getting people around cities. I'm not insisting on doing things some old way because of nostalgia. I want to do things in a way which has a proven track record of actually working. You know, recently we've seen the disappearance of the embossed numerals on credit and debit cards. They're flat now, which means that you can no longer use the old type machine with the roller where you put the carbon paper on top of the card to pass the roller over it and it impresses the embossed letters into the carbon paper. Now, that kind of system gives you a pretty high degree of certainty that the actual card was present when the impression was taken. The banks don't want anybody using that system anymore because A, there are other species of fraud to which it is susceptible, but B, it costs them more to process the paper slips and there's a time delay, whereas with the electronic methods of processing, everything happens almost instantaneously and it costs them very little once they have the whole network in place. Of course, a part of that is making the merchant, in many cases, pay for the terminal and the telecommunications service to connect the terminal, and so on. Whereas, when the merchant was in the practice of bringing the credit slips to the bank had to assume that kind of expense. So part of this is cost shifting. But the thing I observe is not having that fallback, well, they say, oh, wireless data is ubiquitous these days. Poppycock. I believe I've mentioned this before. Last year, at the World Science Fiction Convention in Chicago, the dealer's room was in the basement convention space of the hotel. Well, there is no cellular phone reception in the basement convention space of the hotel, and the convention apparently had not had the money to pay the hotel to allow internet connections down there. People said there was no Wi-Fi. I personally tested an Ethernet port that I found on a pillar, and it was not live. Well, the result of that was, of course, that people couldn't buy things with credit cards. And so here's the point, right, that If the old method of taking credit card impressions had been available, that would have been a fallback, but it simply isn't available anymore. Now, I'm an advocate, of course, for doing most transactions of daily life with cash. When you have cash, again, you can walk in, you can give it to the person in exchange for goods or services. And that's certainly the simplest route. Now, some people find this inconvenient, but I would argue that for most purposes, much of the time, it really is far more convenient than credit card or Apple Pay or what have you. And I think it's deeply unfortunate. You know, China right now is essentially eliminating the use of cash. I've had some interesting calm conversations with SDFers recently about their adventures in China, trying to pay for even the smallest transactions, like a single piece of chicken, with the state-approved electronic transaction method, for which you need a smartphone, you need a data plan, you need this, you need that, you need another thing. Frankly, when it comes to buying a single piece of chicken, almost the only transaction format that makes sense is to hand the vendor a 1 yuan coin and have him hand you the piece of chicken. Doing it any other way is absurd. So yes, I'm not ashamed to advocate for old ways of doing things when they are really effective, when they work well, when they avoid problems, because many of the new ways of doing things, to be frank, aren't particularly good when they do work, and they're broken a lot of the time. I can see no recommendation in anything which has that set of characteristics. I saw a very interesting comment the other day that people who grew up during the Cold War always lived with the fear of sudden destruction by nuclear missiles raining down on them. And so for them, business as usual became something to latch on to, something very comforting. Whereas the younger people today have grown up with a fear of apocalypse by climate change, a gradual grinding away erosion, things just getting worse and worse until you just can't live anymore, until everything that you knew or had is gone. And so for them, business as usual is terrifying, and they seek out sudden change. My response, of course, is that revolutions rarely make anything better, but beyond that, I think the most important point to consider is that the whole idea of fear of the end of the world is stopping us from doing productive things. It's stopping us from making things better, because fear has a tendency to paralyze people. And when it doesn't paralyze people, whether it's sudden terror or lingering dread, fear leads to what I will only call thrashing and flailing. In other words, actions which don't make anything better. Actions often at random or utterly counterproductive actions which don't make anything better. And I think we see a lot of that in the world around us today. Just at a random example, you have people trying to convince other people that the food of the future is ground-up crickets. Why? Doesn't actually make much sense. The plain fact is, if you want a good source of protein and fat that has less environmental footprint than animal protein and fat, the peanut is your friend. Crickets, as it turns out, are still animals, and they're not really any lower on the food chain than cattle and sheep and pigs. I admit that I do wonder whether the whole cricket flour protein thing, which has been noticeably encouraged by some of the Silicon Valley sociopaths, isn't just a kind of prank being pulled on the rest of us by the very wealthy who will continue to eat meat, or they will continue to be vegans, or they will continue to do whatever they want, saying, oh look, we can get the plebs to eat bugs. Of course, I continue to see in the concentration of wealth a very serious danger to our society. Do you know that private equity firms in America are now buying up medical practices in large quantities? And guess what? They're driving up the prices of medical services. Gee. Matter of fact, I heard the other day that the people running the Subway sandwich chain have agreed to sell out to a private equity firm. And I say, that's a real good reason not to eat Subway sandwiches anymore. Not because I have anything against Subway sandwiches, or their franchisees, or the people who work at the restaurants, but because we have to, I think. I'm afraid. We have to, for our own safety, bankrupt these private equity firms, if we possibly can. We have to put them in a situation where borrowing money to buy out companies and then squeezing those companies for every last drop that can be wrung out of them just stops working. Of course, we're in the interesting situation now where there are a bunch of strikes going on. The United Auto Workers have gone on strike against the major automakers. The writers and actors are on strike against the motion picture and television producers. There are strikes breaking out everywhere. And I have to think it's a good thing, honestly. Now, I'm going to close this program by reading something that really confused me. This is from the Journal of College Science Teaching, published by the American Science Teachers Association, from March 1978. And it appears under the title, Nuclear Power, Good or Evil? It's an abstract by Glenn R. McElhattan of a paper in the School Science and Mathematics Journal, What Opinions Do High School Students Hold About Nuclear Science? By Harold L. Crater, Professor of Physics at the University of Mississippi in University, Mississippi. Quote, in recent years, a controversy has raged between the advocates of an increased use of nuclear power and a very vocal opposition. Some of the issues include the need for additional energy, the release of radioactivity by nuclear power facilities, storage of radioactive wastes, the production of plutonium, sabotage, and piracy of nuclear fuel by extremist groups. To sample the attitudes of gifted high school students, a Likert-type summated rating scale of 20 items was administered in pre-test, post-test fashion to two groups of students. One group of 23 participated in a program which included coursework in nuclear and environmental science. A control group of 27 participated in a program involving instruction in mathematics with no instruction in nuclear science. Items on the scale were selected on the basis of their ability to discriminate between favorable and unfavorable attitudes toward nuclear science. A statistical treatment of the results would indicate that for gifted high school students, exposure to coursework in nuclear and environmental science will not affect attitudes toward nuclear science. The investigators were somewhat surprised to find that more than 80% of the students favored increased use of nuclear power for the future, and that fewer than 40% felt that nuclear power and radioactivity represent serious pollution threats. More than 60% felt that the national news media tend to present information about nuclear power in an unfavorable light. The generally uncritical attitudes of the students toward nuclear science might be the result of several factors. Science, as taught in schools, tends to accentuate the successes of scientists in solving problems. Television commercials portray the scientist as an inventor of new miracle products. Science in the United States has often been portrayed as a national effort, such as the lunar program, which provided an American success story. Of course, the dire warnings of ecologists and environmentalists have made an impression. Students are aware of problem areas, but the steady barrage of doomsday prophecies tends to numb the senses. Each day that a person awakens to find that he is not dead from drinking the water or breathing the air suggests that the dire warnings lack validity. The author suggests that teachers must present controversial topics in such a way that students will be prepared to make their own tentative judgments. Many of the decisions that citizens must face are not between right and wrong, but between two evils. I suppose my question for Mr. McElhattan here is, why do you suppose that this shows a generally uncritical attitude of students toward nuclear science? Why do you think that they could only hold these favorable views if they simply haven't considered the relevant facts and information? After all, anybody who's a science teacher ought to be able to look at the data and information available about nuclear energy, even back in 1978, and see that its risks and harms were and are much less than those of other modes of energy production, and that the arguments advanced by the opponents of nuclear energy were and are remarkably weak. It seems as though here we have an example of what has been the attitude of the young Earth creationists and their allies, teach the controversy. And by controversy, they mean a fabricated controversy, not a real one. Of course, no one will be surprised when I say that, so far as I can tell, that has been the approach of the opponents of nuclear energy to fab...
A non-